This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Today's show is about breaking things. Well, a little later on, we'll hear about the Blumenthal Performing Arts Break-In Convention. It's an international festival of hip-hop dance direct from London, and we will meet the director. But first, using broken things to make new things. It's part of the Makers Movement, which started about 10 years ago, and Charlotte is in the thick of it. In fact, Saturday, Discovery Place will host the Charlotte Mini Maker Fair. What are these makers making, and what broken stuff are they using? Let's find out. We're joined by Dr. Robert Corbin, Vice President of Learning Experiences at Discovery Place, and Jim Smith, a systems engineer at 3D Systems down in Fort Mill, and founder of GrassrootsEngineering.com. Welcome to you both.
Thank you.
Privileged to be here.
I'm puzzled. I'm mystified. I read a lot about this yesterday. I still don't know what we're talking about, so let's find out. The maker movement's completely new to me and probably to a lot of our listeners, but I'm told it started around 10 years ago, around 2005. Where and what exactly is it?
So the movement did indeed start in the Bay Area and has been around since about 2005, but Mike, how about you and I can remember a time when we had garages and shops and we did activities called tinkering in the garages. Remember back in those days?
Yeah.
Yeah, so we are honoring the fact that you can actually tinker and play with things and invent things. And what is it? It is everything. It is not what people stereotypically think of as tinkering. It is not just engineering and robotics and mechanics. It is textiles and music and food and squishy circuits and I really do contend that after the Industrial Revolution, we sort of lost the connection between our minds and our hands, right? So it's really how do we create things? There's a great Latin phrase, homo faber, which means man the maker. And so the idea is that it's intrinsically in all human beings, this desire to create.
So let's back up.
Sure.
Going back to the Dark Ages,
sure,
when we tinkered, is that the Heathkit period of our lives? Back when people would make their own radios or own computers with Heathkit things that they buy at Radio Shack or something like that?
Yeah, so I bet you remember having Erector sets,
right?
And I bet you still remember Lego, right?
Of course.
So I think biologically, I think it's probably a fact, biologically, we have no choice but to tinker. It's part of the triune brain, right? We have the desire to tinker, to play, to experience tools and to imagine what would happen if we smash things together.
So now, the other thing that I said at the beginning of the show, that this is about people who take broken things, broken parts from computers, plastics, electronics, circuit boards, things like that, that don't work anymore and make something new from them. And I got that from, I think, Wikipedia, because I had no idea. Is that what's going on here at this fair?
Sure. It is also not, the things don't necessarily have to be broken. So there are a whole range of things. So let me give you a couple of examples. There is a device called a Makey Make, where you can actually called a Makey Make, and this device is actually an interface that would allow you to do things like use fruit as a keyboard to play a banana piano, if you can imagine. There is the opportunity to, in Discovery Place, we'll be doing these things. Saturday, you can actually do squishy circuits where you use Play-Doh to create circuits that will create light. It is just putting together ideas from a bunch of different domains of knowledge to see just what might happen.
Are they called squishy circuits because the Play-Doh is squishy? Is
yes,
that
sir.
What they're called that?
Yes, sir.
May I ask a silly question?
Sure.
Thank you. Why would you want to do that?
So that is actually a great question, right? So we have sort of lost track of the importance of play, right? The importance of discovery. So Discovery Place's mission is that we exist to inspire curious thinkers about the wonders of science, technology, and nature, right? So what is more wonder-filled than to tinker and to play and to discover what happens for no other reason but to tinker and to play? We do enough serious scholarly work through formal schooling, right? Mm-hmm. I think we actually need to incorporate play more vigorously into the curriculum because it is what unites us as human beings. It's, again, homo faber.
Now, the Makers Fairs, the Maker Movement Maker Fairs, are not just happening here. They happen all over the country, and they have for some time, and they are billed as the greatest show and tell on Earth.
Right.
This is Charlotte's first.
Right.
Why is Discovery Place hosting? How did you get turned on to this movement?
Right.
When did it happen for you?
So the culture at Discovery Place and the culture in Charlotte is a make culture. We have just created this fair as a means of bringing people together. So how do you smash together memes, ideas from various ways of thinking? You do that by bringing together people that invent, create, and tinker from a wide variety of backgrounds. People tinker in music, they tinker in writing, they tinker in art, they tinker in engineering, in science, in computing, in 3D printing. So it's really important to bring those folks together just to see what might emerge.
And most of these people, and we have a tinkerer with us, Jim Smith, who I'm going to bring you into this, Jim.
Yeah.
most of these people tinker in the solitude of their own home, in their garage, in their basement, in their hobby room, in their man cave, wherever it may be, or their woman cave, because there are a lot of women who do this too. But you're asking them to come out of the shadows and be on public display.
So there's actually, believe it or not, Mike, there's actually a maker manifesto.
Okay.
Which talks about the importance not just of tinkering, but the importance of communicating what it is that you've created and sharing what it is that you created, right? So how do we become inspired to think about new possibilities in the world? That happens as a consequence of tinkering, but it also happens as a consequence of having dialogue with others that are tinkering and thinking about possibilities, right? So I won't go off on innovation because that's dogmatic, but innovation occurs as a consequence of meeting people that think in ways different from the way that you think.
So you're bringing 70 exhibitors, vendors, teachers, speakers, and performers. I'm not sure how performers work into this, but we'll find out, together for this event on Saturday from 10 to 4 at Discovery Place. Where did you find them? Are they all local? Are you importing some of these folks from outside the area?
So that's a great question. We actually do have some folks that are coming. So the movement is, in fact, a national, frankly, an international movement, right? And so, again, all people make. So we have a lot of great local makers, but we do have some folks coming in nationally. For example, we will have a 3D printed Cobra, an actual functional car that is a 3D printed car, right? So there's another part of the make movement that I'd like to discuss, and it is really the democratization of make, right? So I have this ongoing dialogue with a colleague of mine about my phone versus his phone. And he says, because I have to take my phone to an expert, I don't truly own it. He thinks that he can take his phone apart, that he can code his phone, program his phone, and so he owns it. So part of the make movement is if you tinker with something and you can take it apart and put it back together, then you truly own it. And so there are a lot of people that think this way, and there are a lot of extraordinarily talented people that think that way that live in the Charlotte area.
Jim Smith is evidently one of those people because you were discovered by Science Friday. They came and interviewed you for a Science Friday program because you were into 3D printing, and
yes,
that got you a job.
It did.
You were up in upstate New York.
I was.
And that appearance got you a job at 3D Systems in Fort Mill, which is one of the world's largest manufacturer of 3D printing devices. Is that correct?
Yes, it's actually in Rock Hill, but
excuse me.
Yes, it's the world's leading 3D printer manufacturer.
Okay, and they've been on this program several times, and you are bringing to this event the world's first 3D printed kayak.
Yes.
How big is this thing?
Yes, it's about an 18-foot long kayak.
You printed this thing?
Yes.
Yeah. Tell me how you did it.
So a couple of years ago, I built a 3D printer, and that's how I got the Science Friday interview. But what I wanted to do is I wanted to print something that would really show off the capabilities of 3D printing. So a kayak fit that really well because I was able to customize it to my body type. And also, it's a very relatable thing. People can relate to a kayak, as well as fully functional.
What do you mean you customized it to your body type? It's like having a suit custom made for you. Is that what it is?
Yeah, basically. So
you built it around you and your body.
Exactly. So with 3D printing, you can do more complex things, but it's just for me. It's customization for one.
How do you do it? Do you scan yourself and figure out the seat needs to be this wide, this deep?
Yeah, well, basically, I started with the model of the kayak, and I kind of tweaked it. Probably the width would be one of the things to make it a little more stable side to side because it is a long, narrow sea kayak.
Now Dr. Corbin has mentioned several times 3D printing in relationship to making things, and this is the democratization because 3D printers are now available for ordinary mortals to own in their own home. but right now they only print relatively small objects. You're talking about having printed a kayak.
Yeah.
You have a big printer?
I have a big printer, but it's actually printed in 28 sections, 28 large sections that are bolted together to create the kayak.
And where did the design for this come from? Because you had to figure out how to bolt it together so it wouldn't leak. Because it's actually, you can put this in the water and use it, right?
Yes, in Lake Wylie. Yes.
Okay, so, I mean, how did you figure all that out? How did you actually physically design the, how many pieces did you say came
28.
In? 28 pieces.
Yeah. So first I started with some free plans online to start with the overall shape of the kayak, but then it had to be cut up into sections and reinforcements with thicker sections to build strength of the part. And then holes for all the screws.
We're talking about making things today and the Maker Fair coming up this Saturday on Charlotte Talks today on WFAE. So you printed this kayak rather than – is this the first thing – the first kayak you've ever made?
Yes.
And you printed it because you couldn't buy one that you liked, or you couldn't make one in a more traditional fashion that you liked, or because you are – I use this in the best possible way, Jim – a geek, and you. This is a way to use the technology.
Yeah, exactly. To really have something custom fit to me, and also to inspire others.
Wow, yeah. How did it work out? It floats.
It floats. Yeah.
And is it a good kayak? I mean, insofar I don't know how you judge a kayak, but insofar as kayaks go and your experience with them, is it a good kayak? Was it worth the effort? What did you learn from doing this?
Yes, it was worth the effort. It is a pretty good kayak. It's a long, narrow sea kayak, so it's pretty fast. You can think about it this way. When the maker movement was probably starting about 10 years ago, becoming more popular, about that time, 3D printers were becoming more affordable.
Right.
The affordability was decreasing, and it still is. So what people find is, this really allows makers to be able to easily create and bring their ideas to life quickly.
And we talked about this when the folks from 3D Systems and other companies that do this were with us several years ago. This really is something that allows you to produce in 3D, if not the final product, at least a prototype, to see what changes have to be made to make the real thing down the road. But the real thing could then be printed, because you can print anything. How is 3D printing? I don't know which one of you to ask this question, but how is it changing the world? How is it changing people's ability in their garage to make stuff that they've created on their own?
Well, with desktop printers, like I was saying, you can actually, quickly create something from nothing, really. You're building up something from nothing.
But don't you have to have some sort of CAD abilities, the computer-assisted design abilities first before you can actually tell the printer what to print and how to do it?
You can do that, but also online there's lots of repositories that have lots of models you can print and actually tweak fairly easily without knowing 3D modeling software. But there's actually a number of simple-to-use softwares coming out.
But then aren't you limited to the materials that you can use? For instance, your kayak is made out of what?
ABS plastic.
ABS plastic.
So Lego-like plastic.
Because it's melting strands of plastic and pushing them through a nozzle.
Correct.
Directed by a computer.
Mm-hmm.
And just like a dot matrix printer would have figured out how to make the letters on a page, this knows where to put the material to make whatever it is you're
making.
Exactly.
It's like a very accurate hot glue gun.
Okay.
You can think about it.
Is that something that's liable to change for makers, whether they be industrial makers or they be individuals, in the next couple of years? Are we going to have a wider array of materials? Will I be able to make a hot fudge sundae on this thing?
Yes. So I could talk about
it. You can talk about it when we come back from the break, because we have to take a break. Jim Smith is with us, systems engineer and founder of 3D of grassrootsengineering.com. He works for 3D Systems. And Dr. Robert Corbin from Discovery Place, where the Charlotte Mini Maker Fair is going on this weekend. We're coming right back. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about all things breaking today, how we're taking broken things and making them into new things, as illustrated by the Charlotte Mini Maker Fair this Saturday from 10 to 4 at Discovery Place. Later in the program, the Breakin' Convention. We'll be talking about that with the director of this international phenomenon. Dr. Robert Corbin is with us in this segment, Vice President of Learning Experiences at Discovery Place, and Jim Smith with 3D Systems, and also the founder of GrassrootsEngineering.com, who will be at the Maker Fair this weekend with his
kayak,
his printed, digitally printed kayak, which floats and operates rather well, evidently.
Yes.
This is something, this technology has been around for a long time, but it really is changing the way things are made.
Yeah. So within the past couple of years, you know, in the media, 3D printing has become really popularized. But a lot of people don't realize that it's been around for over 30 years. So if you think about it, 3D printing is already touching all of our lives already. Mm-hmm. From the car you drive to the planes you fly out of Charlotte, a lot of the parts on those machines have been either prototyped or actually the parts wax molds have been casted out of 3D printed parts to create those. You know, for some practical examples, is 95% of all hearing aids are 3D printed, as well as our company makes the machines that print Invisalign, which is the braces substitute.
Yeah. Really? They're 3D printed?
$20 million a year, custom for individual people.
I'll be darned. This Maker Faire is all about people, individuals, making things. What we're talking about right now is using 3D printing on an industrial scale. But
yes.
3D printing has allowed people to do things that they really could never do before. But it's not just about 3D printing. It's about people making jewelry. It's about people making all kinds of things. But in this world where you can buy almost anything that you want at a relatively reasonable price, unless, of course, it's a Tesla. And if you can tell me how to 3D print a Tesla, I'm on board. Why do people want to make things when it's readily available all around them at an inexpensive price?
So it is definitely innately human to create things. And one of the things that I love that Jim said is the customization is a really, really cool aspect of making too. So as I look across the table at you, Mike, I notice that you're wearing glasses, and I'm wearing glasses too. And it occurs to me that the glasses that we're wearing are really the average of all human beings' glasses, right? The distance between our eyes is based on the average of all of humanity rather on your actual distance between the centers of your eyes, right? Wouldn't it be cool if every single thing that you owned and wear was customized to Mike or customized to Robert? There's another really inspiring example of why customization is really important, and this is a really cool North Carolina connection. The Wake Forest Institute for Regenerative Medicine is actually 3D printing bladders and kidneys. So there are people that are walking around this planet right now that have 3D printed customized bladders and kidneys based on, you know, repositories within the printer that extract stem cells. So to the prior point, it is not just ABS. We are 3D printing food with sugars and resins and printing things with stem cells.
I actually saw a beating heart yesterday on a video that I watched about this that was made through 3D printing. And I'm curious, are they, when they make these things, when there are people walking around with these 3D printed organs in their bodies, do the stem cells come from them so that there is no rejection of that organ as a foreign body as you would if for a transplant patient?
So my understanding is that is a relatively tenuous question, right?
Okay.
So the stem cells will either sort of recognize the environment they are in and will grow according to what they're supposed to be, or they will not. And there are cases where a regimen of drugs have got to be applied in order to make sure that the organ is not rejected. But there are definitely people that are living normal lives as a consequence of having these organs 3D printed, which is truly extraordinary. And I love the fact that it is a North Carolina connection. It's fantastic.
But again, this Maker Faire is not just about 3D printing.
Right,
we're kind of stuck in the technology here. That's where I like to go with things. But it's about canning. It's about dressmaking. It's about jewelry making. It's about people who do things with their hands. And this is, a celebration of it?
Right.
But it's also a series of workshops for others who might want to figure out that they would be interested in doing that.
So here's an excellent example of something that is not 3D printing, which we experimented with. We're in a long-term relationship with UNCC, and we have been involved in what's called the Intersections Project. So imagine, if you will, that you're in a creative writing class or an AP English class, and rather than just writing essays, you know, we tend to focus almost exclusively in schooling on the ability to write and the ability to calculate. Imagine how cool it would be if, when you're reading a classic novel, let's just say Moby Dick, that you go through make cycles and you are actually creating things that are representative artifacts from that novel, or you are actually creating performances that are associated with that novel. So we have been iteratively doing this and experimenting with teachers and students in making objects, artifacts. Actually, we're encouraging students to hack their writing, right? So creating and making is, yes, it is indeed performance. It is writing. It is honoring all of the alternative forms of representation of knowledge that are out there above and beyond the ability to calculate and to write. Those things are critically important, of course, but there are so many complex ways to represent what it is that we know, to honor what we know, and to share what we know.
There are 135 million American adults, I'm told, who are part of this maker movement. And I'm finding that interesting because until we decided to do this program, I had never heard of it. Did I miss that day in class?
If you think about it, it is always sort of been a subcurrent of our culture, right? I'm sure that everybody in this room knows somebody that has been an extraordinary tinkerer or handyman or woman or just likes to fiddle around with things and to create new things. And this is, you know, what I love, by the way, going back to the Wake Forest example, is that it truly is the intersection of material science, of art, of engineering, of performance, of advancement, of business. It is all of those things. And that is really the direction that we're going. If you think about the information revolution, if we're to be successful in society now, we have to sort of master multiple epistemological communities, I call them, multiple ways of knowing. If we're going to be successful, you need to be able to perform. You need to be able to create, to build, to articulate science, to write, to calculate. All of those things are necessary.
Getting back again to 3D printing, you've printed this kayak, which you've used in Lake Wiley, and Lake Norman, Lake Wiley, and it works, and it doesn't leak, and it's fairly speedy because it's an ocean-going kayak that you've built, 3D printed. What else have you made?
A lot of different things, yeah.
Like, what are you most proudest of?
Probably the kayak.
Okay. Second.
It's hard to think of one example. I mean, there's so many things. Like at the company I work for, we can print from everything from titanium to chocolate and, you know, everything in between.
So I can get my hot fudge sundae.
You can?
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you. I'll look forward to bring one next time. As part of the Mini Maker Fair, why is it called Mini for it, by the way? Is it just
so,
a small gathering?
So believe it or not, this is such a huge – the make movement is so large that actually having 72 exhibitors is actually relatively small, right? So we will actually close down Tryon Street between 6th and 7th, and we will have – most of the folks are going to be inside the museum, but there will be people actually on the street too. So yes, it's relatively small, but don't underestimate the importance. This is a watershed moment for Charlotte. It is so, so very important to have a vibrant culture, to honor people who create in all of its iterations. So it's a very, very important thing, and it really creates Charlotte as a nexus for making. So there is one other thing that I want to mention that is so profound about what Jim has done, and it's so important to think this way. So to give people tools and to simply say, like 3D printers or CNC machines or laser cutters or Mickey Makes or Raspberry Pi, to give people those tools.
I don't know what you're talking about.
To give people those are all tools that allow you to create and to make and to code and to build. Is such a profound thing, because what you're really saying is, here are tools and possibilities. So as an example of that, Discovery Place has built over 100 3D printers with teachers and given them to the teachers to take back to their classroom to say to students, what are the possibilities? What is this tool for, right? That is such a far more inductive and profound way of thinking about how it is that we teach and learn. Right, so it's less important so I'm a relatively old guy. It's less important for a 53-year-old guy to say, hey, look what a 3D printer can do, than it is for me to present this to a teacher and to a student and say, hey, what is the purpose of this tool?
Once again, we've gotten bogged down in 3D printing or technology, and Raspberry Pi is not the pie you eat. It is a piece of technology. It's a small computer, is
yes,
it not?
Yes, it is.
Right. Who do you want to see come to this? Because if you're not technological by nature, if you're befuddled by an iPad, will you enjoy this experience?
Oh, my gosh, yes. And so there are assumptions made about MAKE, that it is primarily for males, that it is primarily for techies, but it is really democratization of everything. It is performance. It is dance. It is making jewelry. It is painting. It is Everything that you can imagine. It is cuisine. It is textiles. It is everything. So it really is for everybody. And there is something for everybody to be fascinated in.
So as part of the fair, and since you are in charge of learning experiences at Discovery Place, there will be a lot of workshops where people can find out about a variety of things. Mm-hmm. And I went through the list yesterday. I've just picked a few out at random. Mm-hmm. Practical post-apocalyptic electronics.
Right. So
what is that?
So
and do I need to worry?
I don't necessarily want to evoke popular culture, but if you think of shows like The Walking Dead,
yeah,
or you think about post-apocalyptic needs, right? So one of the themes that is consistently represented there is what happens when the infrastructure goes away, right? So this workshop is about how you actually would be able to generate electricity by being off of the grid. How can you be self-reliant, that strong individual would be able to survive and would be able to generate electricity, generate heat on your own without the support of somebody else. And that's really a profound thing if you think about it, right? What does it actually mean to be off the grid? It means that I am in control of how I get heat, how I get energy, how I get food, how I move around, right?
Yeah.
And I would argue that a lot of people have forgotten how to do those things.
Oh, that's a good argument, because when the power goes out, I don't know what to do at all. I'm at a complete loss. So in a workshop, you can figure that out. You can teach people that in a workshop.
Well, I mean, we can give them a tinge, right? And so the make movement again is iterative, right? So we can give them experiences that would allow them to be interested and to spark that curiosity to go forth. Which again, that's our very proud mission. Right? That's why we exist.
But then you're also doing workshops on things that are really a throwback to almost an ancient time. You're teaching people how to work with glass, how to melt various different shards of glass and make them into something new and different. This is something this is how they made stained glass in the Middle Ages.
Right.
What kind of things are you showing people?
So we have this relatively new enterprise called the Education Studio, where we've actually taken teachers through and showed them how to create jewelry and essentially couture objects. And those couture objects could be anything. They can be something that would hold your iPhone to earrings to something that just is sculptural in nature. So those things are things that we consistently think about. So it is important to stay in tune with wonder and inspiration, right? Sometimes it is less important to think about why you're creating something in terms of a purpose than it is to simply create.
So on the one hand, from somebody who's never been to one of these things, it sounds like a technology exhibition married to an arts and crafts fair.
It truly is. So one of the phrases that we have left out, which is really important about make, is DIY, do it yourself. So it is not just technology. It is about art. It is about how I play music. We have some great performances, Drumstrong. We have a group from UNCC that is going to be coming out, and they have actually transformed a shipping vessel into a mobile stage. They're doing really cool work. We're doing really cool work with them. So this democratization of make, by the way, it will extend beyond. We have always done this at Discovery Place. It'll extend beyond Saturday. We are doing what is called pop-up make. So imagine how cool it is if you are a resident of Greer Heights or Renaissance West or Montclair, and you go to a bus stop and you see a person that is actually blowing off high-pressure rockets, right? Or you see someone that is actually experimenting with optics just in the street, right? That's going to spark curiosity, and it's so important to remember the wonder for the world and the wonder for the universe.
Discovery Place's Charlotte Mini Maker Fair is what we're talking about. It's Saturday from 10 to 4 at Discovery Place here on North Tryon. On Charlotte Talks this morning, you have a forum on turning whatever idea you may have into a book. You have a forum on honeybees and how they make honey. I'm not sure why we need to know that, except we won't put it on a piece of bread. You have something described as more exciting than 3D printing called laser cutters.
Mm-hmm.
Has that technology come down in – because I know that they use laser cutters to do these fancy paper cuts that are just crisp and clean and wonderful and highly detailed. But has that come down in price to the point where an average person in a home can have a laser cutter?
It's they're in thousands
they're
of
starting
dollars.
To, yeah.
Yeah, they're starting to.
I Very think recently, actually.
And what are people doing with them?
So we have done a whole range of things. We just took 50 teachers through from Mountain Island Academy. We just took them through a workshop where they build houses for nuthatches, right? And so the customization is there. So a nuthatch is a particular size. You can make the entrance a particular, the hole a particular size. Mm-hmm. We are creating tchotchkes too. We're creating devices to hold business cards. A whole range of things, signs. We are actually laser cutting out hydroponic systems out of plastic that you put together, assemble together. It's infinite. The possibilities are infinite.
You also have another technology, a workshop, forum, whatever you want to call it, a session on the Internet of Things and mm-hmm. home automation. How does that interface with the maker culture?
So imagine how cool it is if you literally have everything that is in your household that requires you to moderate it available through a handheld device or available remotely. So imagine if we had a heating and cooling system in our home that was responsive to our handheld devices, where if we are out of the office, we can know what the temperature is in our household and we mm-hmm. can change it according to what is needed.
But can't you do that with a Nest?
Yeah, you absolutely can. But the point of the Internet of Things is that everything is connected to everything else. So you would be able to moderate mm-hmm. and change any device that is modifiable from a remote location.
So there's something there this weekend for people of all ages, people of disparate interests, and you don't have to be an electronics whiz kid to understand what's going on. There's something there for you. And you mentioned body parts, mm-hmm. body part printing, and you're bringing in Chris Leggett from Fayetteville, who's going to be talking about this because he is a maker of those things. Dr. Robert Corbin with us from Discovery Place, Jim Smith from 3D Systems and GrassrootsEngineering.com. The Charlotte Mini Maker Fair is Saturday all day, 10 to 4, at Discovery Place. Thank you for being here. Appreciate
it. Thanks for having us.
Thanks.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. On to a different type of break-in now. Blumenthal Performing Arts Break-In Convention, an international festival of hip-hop dance, which comes to town tomorrow and Saturday at the Knight Theater and also here at Spirit Square. The Break-In Convention was launched 12 years ago, if I've done the math right, in London and became an annual event there, the artistic quality of which has been compared to more traditional dance forms, such as ballet. And now Charlotte gets to experience this artistic form as performed by some of its best practitioners from around the world. The artistic director of the Break-In Convention, Jonesy D, has been actively involved in Britain's hip-hop culture since its beginnings in the 80s and has committed himself to the development of hip-hop theater. Break-In Convention is a resident company at Sadler's Wells, a world leader in contemporary dance, and Jonesy D joins us for the rest of the hour. Welcome to you. Thanks for being here.
Absolute pleasure. Wonderful Charlotte morning.
Yeah, it's beautiful, isn't it? Not like London. Also with us is the man who, with this show, by his own admission, is blowing up perceptions of what the Blumenthal brings to its stages, but also to what hip-hop is, and that would be Blumenthal Performing Arts President and CEO Tom Gabbard. Welcome back.
Good morning.
Good morning. The Blumenthal is famous for bringing the Broadway series of shows to town. You're famous for incubating and bringing to town jazz acts and incubating small theater companies, and you've put up with Charlotte Squawks, but this seems like a departure even for you. And I just said, you said that you blew up perceptions with this. Why? Why are you doing this? Why did you take this on?
Good question, but I think it is who we are. We're a leader here, and so, you know, trying to create new ways to look at the arts, but particularly, you know, I think we're focused on trying to make sure that our audience in Charlotte looks like Charlotte, that it's as diverse in every respect possible, and Break-In Convention gives us a really wonderful opportunity to embrace the community in a whole new way.
How did you find it? This started in London, but how did you find out about it? How did you know about it? Had you seen it before you brought it?
Yeah, we've had a great relationship with Sadler's mm-hmm. over the years, and particularly working with Matthew Bourne, who is a right. resident artist there. And so through my visits there, I became aware of Breaking Convention and became more and more intrigued. The staff began to talk to me about it. And so a couple of years ago, I had my first experience. And then we invited John Z here a year and a half ago to just evaluate whether or not we had the right makings. And fortunately, he concluded yes.
What are the right makings?
Well, I think the right makings are an urban environment, first and foremost, and I don't mean urban as a euphemism for a particular ethnic category. I mean cities. Any city around the world today, you will find hip-hop culture. Usually when you walk around and you'll see little tags on the street, oh, that's an indication of hip-hop culture. Also, the fact that it is the main cultural context for a lot of young people around the world today. Hip-hop means art, means freedom, it means creativity, and that is what I was looking for when I came to Charlotte. And I found it.
Larry Topman in the paper this morning pointed out something interesting and that I kind of thought of yesterday, but he wrote about it, so I'll give him the credit. and that is that hip-hop, I think, if he's right, got started here in this country.
That's right.
And you have a hip-hop culture in England, and you are kind of the guy bringing it to our attention from across the Atlantic. Why did it take somebody from Britain to tell America about its own invention?
Well, in my opinion, I'd say since its humble beginnings in the 70s in the Bronx, hip-hop has promised lots of things. For example, peace, love, unity, and having fun. It was created within a context in which people were struggling to live. People were literally living on top of each other in the Bronx as a result of the Cross Bronx Expressway. Yeah. Mm. All of a sudden, all these communities had to shift and live on top of each other and to find out what it means to live. And through that, you either die through the struggles of gang activity, of living in an environment where there's not many resources, or you find a way to live. And the way of living was through the block party. Yeah. And at this block party, which was started by the DJ, dancers would come rather than battle against each other to for land or your property or whatever. You're just battling each other with your dance skills, or you're battling with your rap skills or your DJ skills. So in a way, it's a way of staying alive, and it's a way of conflict resolution.
You bring up a lot of things. We have so much to talk about here. Lin-Manuel Miranda has the hottest show on Broadway right now. It's called Hamilton. Before that, he had In the Heights. And In the Heights kind of brought a little taste of hip-hop. And evidently, I've not seen Hamilton yet, but evidently Hamilton brings it full-blown. And it's showing people who are not normally exposed to that the power of that form of art and the way you put words together, the way people move. Mm. Well, you knew this years ago. You were way before Lin-Manuel Miranda got to Broadway with his two shows.
Right.
Are you the spearhead? Are you the progenitor of all of this, really? Well, moving it into the legitimate world?
What I will say is that I was doing this when I first discovered hip-hop in 1982.
And you were a kid.
I was a little kid, you know, a very little kid. And what I discovered was that this dance style was, it belonged to me. There was a sense of empowerment that I had. It wasn't like a dance style where there were lots of older people telling me, now this is the way you've got to do it, now turn out your legs and stretch. None of that. This was something that I felt that I could learn myself. It was the ultimate in self-empowerment. So for me, when I first started doing hip-hop, I first started discovering other people around doing this culture, and we all just said, you know, this is ours, because our older brothers and family members, they would not roll around on the floor. Their clothes are way too nice and pristine. Whereas when you're 13, the idea of finding creativity while rolling around on the floor made complete sense.
Well, now, you did get training. You went to the London Contemporary Dance School.
Yes.
And while you were there, if I understand this correctly, you actually asked one of the instructors, well, when are we going to learn this, meaning hip-hop moves, yes, and break moves and things like that. And they told you that you weren't, because that's not what this is about. And then you began to wonder why,
yes,
this form had not achieved the legitimacy of traditional ballet or modern contemporary dance had already achieved on stages, on, yes, proscenium arch stages.
Yes.
And you set out to do that?
Yes. I was confused when I was at the London Contemporary Dance School. The title, London Contemporary Dance, tells me that you're looking for dance of today, new dance. So I was questioning, why am I learning dance techniques that were called contemporary, but actually they were developed in the 1930s. Martha Graham technique, Cunningham technique, even Bill Paxton with the release work, which was new, was, you know, around circa 1967, the early 70s. So my question was, we're avoiding a very contemporary dance style, yeah? And my question was, is it because of the cultural context of it, yeah? This is in relation to theatre as being a document of status. And that's the thing that really, really worried me. Mm. Because for me, the theatre is a building, yeah, in which we can house any development in creativity. So the argument that hip-hop doesn't belong there because that's a street dance form didn't make sense to me. So I was always trying to get this contemporary folk dance form to the heady heights of classical forms.
Well, you did it, because Sadler's Wells is well known around the world as being a place where this kind of thing, high concept art or legitimate art takes place, dance art takes, mm-hmm, place. How did you get their attention? How did you convince them to bring you in as a resident company? How did that happen?
Well, I was touring a show called Aeroplane Man around Europe and America, actually. I did the New York City Hip Hop Theater Festival in 99. And while I was touring, I discovered a lot of people doing hip hop in the theater, in particular Europe, Holland, France in particular. They really have progressed when it comes to this discipline in the theatre. So Alistair Spaulding, the chief executive, who was then head of dance at the Queen Elizabeth Hall, he programmed my show Aeroplane Man. And at that time I said to him, Alistair, I am not the only person that's exploring this hip-hop dance. There's a lot of people, and I would like to show that I'm part of a community as opposed to this one anomaly in London that was exploring hip-hop in the theatre. So, yeah, I told him about it. Then he got his job as chief exec at Sadler's Wells, and then one of the first things he did was called me and said, Johnsy, let's do this.
So Breaking Convention, which is the name of this, Breaking Convention Charlotte 2015, actually CLT, because it's hipper, 2015 at the Knight Theater this weekend, is kind of a play on words. It is a convention. It's a performance. It's workshops. It's involving people from the community. So in that way, it's a convention, but you're also breaking the convention of what is expected to be on the Knight Theater stage when a dance thing performance is underway. That was your goal here?
It certainly is. And breaking the convention of how audiences engage with us. We have activities at the night that will start at 5 o'clock on Friday and Saturday night. The performance doesn't start till 7:30, but there's a stage out in front that Blues Rogers has headed up. There'll be spoken word, DJs, other things. Places to sit, have something to eat that starts at 5. Inside, starting 90 minutes before, so at 6 o'clock, there are cipher stages, a DJ, there'll be graffiti art that you can participate in. Those are totally different ways for audiences to engage with us. The other thing that's important to note that I just have such admiration for John Z's direction on this is that we have really embraced the local arts scene in a big way. And so local artists are featured on stage, woven right in with the international artists. We have local artists who've decorated the Knight Theater with wonderful graffiti art. So local artists as well as these international artists have been woven together in a way that's quite unique.
This hip-hop grew out of the street. Mm-hmm. And what you've done here by moving to Sadler's Wells and taking these shows around the world and putting them in the Night Theater for this weekend, you've given legitimacy to this, and not only to the art form, but to the performers themselves, because when they find themselves in these beautiful venues, suddenly they realize what I'm doing here is important.
Yes. And it matters, and it's acknowledged as art. It's acknowledged as the future of what we can possibly do in theatre. There are limitations to current theatrical practice where dance is concerned. Yeah, you know, as we know, ballet is a very important part of the fabric of dance theatre culture. Mm-hmm. But I also believe that there is a blockage, yeah, with the technique itself. What's happening with hip-hop dance techniques is that we're pushing the body to extremes that we've never seen before. And I think that's really important when it comes to making new work.
We have examples of what you're talking about and what this show is about on our website at wfae.org/charlottetalks. And we're talking about Breaking Convention CLT 2015 at the Night Theater, Friday and Saturday. BlumenthalArts.org has more information about that. You posed a question, Jonesy, in a TED Talk that I watched yesterday, which kind of blew my mind. You said, why is hip-hop not part of the national arts curriculum? Now, we don't have a national arts curriculum in America. We probably should, but in England they do. Is it now part of the arts curriculum? And because it came from the street, why does it need to be?
Okay. If we just look at the last 100 years of dance culture, we will see a dance style that was on the street, tap dance, jazz dance styles, that are now being studied in academies all around the country. Yeah, so I think we can just look at history to see what the dynamic of new dance forms from America will eventually end up doing. I think that there's an important thing to talk about, which is apartheid.
Okay.
Yeah. As we know, there were some amazing jazz musicians that are American, yeah, that felt that they had to go to Europe to be able to get their art recognized and respected, and then they came back. Mm-hmm. So I think that in a funny way, hip hop as a culture is doing that. It's leaving America. It's going to Europe. It's manifesting and developing itself as a genre. And now we're coming back to America.
If it's good enough for Europe, it must be good. And therefore, that's what happens, isn't it? I mean, we have to have – that's why we like British accents. That's why we have Masterpiece Theater, because if they speak with a British accent, it must be good.
Yes.
Well, thank you for legitimizing it for us.
No problem. We've got some amazing British artists performing as well. We'll probably get into that in a little bit, but I just wanted to touch on it now. Top drama program in America right now is a British actor leading it, and he will be on stage at the Blumenthal this weekend.
Who?
Ukweli Roach, his name is.
And what show is he on?
Oh, the name has escaped me.
It's okay.
But I'll find it for you.
It's all right.
It's all right, innit?
I'll figure it out.
Dude, that was the best of UK accent I've heard while I've been here.
Breaking Convention at the Night Theater, October 9th and 10th. That's this Friday and Saturday. BlumenthalArts.org. John Z. D. is the artistic director, and Tom Gabbard is the man responsible for bringing it back to our shores here. President and CEO of Blumenthal Performing Arts. Thank you both for being here. Appreciate it.